It's Tuesday, November 3rd, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Hello. Coming up, questions and mysteries surround the crash of a Russian passenger jet. The Australian and Chinese Navy sail side by side.
We worry about viruses and bacteria becoming pandemics, spreading all over the world.
The Ebola virus. We present the second part of our conversation with a top researcher. Also ahead, two pop singers hit the road, leaving behind another star. It's all coming up on today's International Edition. A Russian investigator says the Metrojet Airbus A321, which crashed more than 20 minutes after takeoff Saturday from Sharm el-Sheikh in Egypt to St. Petersburg, broke up in midair after reaching about 9,400 meters in altitude. But Viktor Sorochenko of the Intergovernmental Aviation Committee cautioned it's too early to draw any conclusions. All 224 people on board Flight 9268, mostly Russian tourists, were killed, and most of the bodies of the victims have been returned to Russia. Debris is scattered over some 16 square kilometers of Egypt's Sinai Peninsula. All A321s in Metrojet's fleet have been grounded until the reason for the crash becomes clear. The two black box recorders, which contain vital flight data and cockpit voice recordings, are being examined by investigators. Islamic State affiliate militants in Sinai claimed responsibility for downing the commercial aircraft. Scott Hamilton is the editor of News and Comments of the Seattle-based aviation consultancy Lehman Company, and he discussed with VOA's Victor Beatty what the Russian investigator might mean about breaking apart in mid-flight.
There's either going to be a catastrophic structural failure or mechanical failure, or perhaps a bomb. It is very, very rare to have an airplane break up at cruise altitude. Now, it's also been reported that in 2001, it had major damage from a tail strike on takeoff or landing. I'm not sure which, in Cairo. So obviously, investigators are going to really pay close attention to that as well.
The plane apparently lost contact with air traffic control 23 minutes after takeoff. About what altitude might it be at that point?
I think the reports were that it was around 31,000 feet.
And is it possible that something fired from the ground could bring an aircraft down at that height?
Well, according to the news reports, the ISIS didn't have any missiles that could go above 20,000 feet or thereabouts. That still doesn't rule out the possibility of a bomb that was planted on the airplane. And obviously with this tail strike report, that's going to be a particular area of focus. But with the flight data and cockpit voice recorders recovered, there should be some indication really almost as soon as they have the investigators have a chance to analyze just what those tell you.
Does the fact that the debris is scattered a certain way suggest that it might be a bomb on board, and would there be residue on the aircraft fragments?
Well, there would be residue on the aircraft fragments. I certainly haven't seen enough information coming out of Egypt yet as to indicate how the debris was scattered. It was apparently scattered over a 7-mile area, which obviously does indicate an in-flight breakup. And according to the news reports, the tail section was found some distance from the main wreckage, which suggests that the tail section separated from the airplane. Again, was it something having to do with a structural issue? Was it something having to do with a bomb? We just don't know at this point.
When that Malaysian jetliner was downed over Ukraine, of course, it turned out to be a missile of some sort that was fired from the ground. Would there be any possible similarity between this incident and that one?
Well, certainly not if the missiles in ISIS control could not go above 20,000 feet and the plane was at 31,000 feet. That would suggest that there was something else at work here.
What do you make of several airliners, particularly Gulf carriers, who are avoiding the Sinai until the cause is determined?
I think that's just a prudence, given that it is a combat zone of sorts. They don't want to have a repeat of the Malaysian MH17 shoot down over Ukraine.
Is airspace worldwide still fairly wide open, or does it become more restricted when you have incidents like this?
It becomes more restrictive when you're over combat zones, and there's a lot of restriction over the Middle East right now because of obviously all the combat that's going on there. Airspace is restricted over North Korea. You know, airlines aren't allowed to fly over North Korea, even though that's a more direct route, say, from Tokyo to Beijing. They have to go down and around South Korea to go into Beijing. So there are airspace restrictions, but anytime you have combat, there's additional restriction.
The A321 is a twin-engine, medium-haul aircraft that has been in service since 1994. It had over 1,100 operating worldwide. Well, we turn to our social media segment now on International Edition. Our own G. Abby Lee is right here in the studio to bring us today's top news online. Hello, G.
Hi, Jim.
What do you have for us today?
The social media app Snapchat changed its privacy policy, and that's getting a lot of attention on Twitter.
Well, we've talked about Snapchat before in our segment. Let's remind our listeners what it is.
Sure. It's a photo and mainly video sharing app that's popular among 13 and 34-year-olds. And more than 60% of the demographic in the United States use it. It also gets about 4 billion views every day based on the company's website.
So it has a younger audience than Facebook or Twitter, and I hear it's growing at a fast pace.
That's right.
Well, going back to the change in its privacy policy, what did Snapchat say about it?
It all started with this tweet. "We are not stockpiling your private snaps. Our updated privacy policy and terms of service explained." That tweet got more than 1,200 shares, and it also includes a link to its website that explains the change.
I see. So what are some of its main changes?
Snapchat is saying that the main change is actually in the wording, because they wanted to make it easier for users to understand. But it also said Snapchat added new language about in-app purchases, announcing they're now selling what's called replays. Last but not least, the company also clarified what info will be visible to users to make it easier for people to find each other. Now, on the same page, it emphasized that private snaps and chats, which are video clips and messages, remain private.
Well, I'm sure a lot of people are relieved about that.
Absolutely. Snapchat is retweeting a lot of positive responses. Like I said earlier, its users tend to be younger, so that gets reflected in the tweets. Here's an example. One user tweeted, "I was so worried when I heard about the Snapchat drama at school, but after their explanation, I am back at sending snaps. Sounds like crisis averted." Another one reads like this, "I know it's just rumors. I love you at Snapchat." Hearing about one social media app on another social media platform lets you know that we live in a truly connected world, whether you like it or not. Jim?
Truly connected. And we thank you for the connection to social media news and all the latest that's going on. G. Abby Lee, you can follow her on Twitter at G. Abby Lee. Also by following our program's account, that would be at VOA_IE. This is VOA.
For more on the stories you've heard on our radio programs, visit our website at voanews.com. That's where you'll find in-depth reports, related stories, videos, and more from our team of correspondents. Or take the news with you by downloading podcasts of your favorite VOA program. That's at voanews.com.
voanews.com.
Online news for a changing world.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel, host of VOA's Encounter. Join me and two advocates from the world of politics, public policy, or academia debating critical and controversial issues of our day, bringing depth, perspective, and insight to the world around us. That's Encounter every Saturday and Sunday on VOA.
This is VOA's International Edition. Australia has begun military exercises with China, and it's not far from the disputed artificial islands of the South China Sea. Canberra insists it's an invaluable chance to work alongside a regional neighbor, while analysts worry that it could be used for propaganda purposes. From Sydney, we hear more now from Phil Mercer, who reports.
The live fire exercises were planned long ago, but come at a time of rising diplomatic tensions in the South China Sea, where the Chinese have tried to further their territorial claims by building new islands. Beginning Monday, the Royal Australian Navy will engage in war games alongside Chinese forces, not far from the disputed waters. Last week, the US sent a warship through the area to assert what it called freedom of navigation. Australian Defence Chief Air Chief Marshal Mark Binskin is playing down diplomatic concerns over the military exercises.
It's a chance to work with regional navies and show transparency and capability in what we do. It's what we do with a lot of regional navies. It's a part of the relationship we have with a lot of the regional navies and in the development between the defence forces. And so we shouldn't make it more than what it actually is.
But Ewan Graham from the Lowy Institute, an independent Sydney-based think tank, believes it's bad timing. He fears the drills could be exploited by China for propaganda purposes.
Australia is proud of its close relationship with the Chinese Navy. There aren't many that are given the ability to operate this closely. The question has to be the current timing and whether this is sending a mixed signal with America just having launched its freedom of navigation operations in the South China Sea.
Australia is believed to be the only Western military to conduct live fire exercises alongside the Chinese. The war games began back in 2010. Australia's relationship with its most powerful partners has presented diplomatic challenges, where it must further its most important trading relationship with China while maintaining historic security ties with the United States. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
Also in the region, South Korean President Park Geun-hye and Japanese Prime Minister Shinzo Abe have agreed to quickly resolve a decades-long dispute over Korean women forced to serve as sex slaves during Japan's brutal occupation of the Korean Peninsula in the first half of the 20th century. Prior to the bilateral summit in Seoul, President Park had refused to meet directly with Abe because of Japan's reluctance to properly acknowledge the plight of the so-called comfort women. On yesterday's program, we heard from Dr. John Dye. He's the chief of the United States Army Medical Research Institute of Infectious Diseases Viral Immunology Branch about the advances in Ebola research and treatment. VOA's Susan Yockey continues that conversation by asking him about safety precautions in trying to study the Ebola virus.
Ebola is so infectious and deadly, you must have to be very careful in your research.
Yes, ma'am. So it's not something that we just bring someone off the streets and pull them in and throw them into a high containment suite. So I personally have gone through years of training with mentors and experts to develop my technique to be able to be safe working with these viruses and bacteria, as do all of my comrades here at USAMRID. And when we bring someone in, they really part of the team, they become part of the team, and you really have to develop a trust when you're working side by side with these individuals in a high containment suite. So training and trust are the two T's that I talk about when I talk about how we go forward working with these viruses and bacteria.
I can remember that when we first started talking about Ebola, there were so many people who were scared that this was going to go all over the world, that it was going to spread because there was no way to stop it. What is your feeling about that?
So I think we worry about viruses and bacteria becoming pandemics, spreading all over the world. This was an epidemic. It spread into multiple countries in Western Africa. Honestly, Ebola isn't really that good, if you want to put quotation marks, of a virus when it comes to what it's supposed to do, because it actually kills its host. A virus isn't actually very good, if you speak in that manner, when it actually kills the organism that it's using to spread itself. So a virus is basically genetic material encapsulated in an envelope, and it uses your or my cells within our body to produce more copies of itself. And so if it kills the person or the cells that it's using to actually spread itself, it's really not that good. So Ebola and viruses, hemorrhagic fever viruses like this, they tend to burn out rather quickly. This was a very different case in Western Africa, and we can discuss that later if you'd like. So it's not that great a virus when it comes to that. So I wasn't concerned about it becoming a pandemic, per se, spreading all over the world. But we now live in an age with globalization and transportation, which is at an all-time high, where you have the ability to jump on a plane and be anywhere in 8 to 12 hours. And there's a latency period, or a period where the virus is ramping up production in the person or the animal that is infected. So you don't really know you're infected, and then maybe you hop on a plane, you head to London, you head to New York, you head to Dallas, Texas, which is exactly what happened in the U.S., and you potentially have a possibility where you could get a spread into different countries.
And you mentioned Africa.
I did. So there's a great concern of it spreading within Africa. The reason why is because the infrastructure of the health systems in these nations in all over Africa is the infrastructure in more developed nations, and that's just a fact. So the ability to basically understand, isolate, and quarantine patients who potentially have this is somewhat restricted in these countries, so you have a greater chance of it spreading within these countries before it's actually come into check.
Trying to stop Ebola is very noble, no matter who you work for, but why is the U.S. Army so particularly interested in this?
That's a great question. So I work for the U.S. Army Department of Defense. I'm a U.S. government employee, and the reason why the U.S. Army is interested in this is we are always concerned that we'll have to send service members and service member families into regions where this particular virus or other viruses and bacteria of this nature are present. So there's that possibility. And then actually, if you look back in history and read books, in the 1980s, it was known before the fall of the Iron Curtain that the Russians were actually weaponizing virus like this. So we have a biothreat component that we're also interested in combating in case that happened.
Thank you very much, Doctor, for taking the time to speak with us. Dr. John Dye and his research was featured on the National Geographic Channel show Breakthrough. It's a new program.
You're listening to International Edition. This is VOA.
The news never stops, so keep current on your mobile device with VOA News. Just go to m.voanews.com/English for instant, up-to-the-minute news and entertainment. Check m.voanews.com/English on your handheld device for news as it happens. Stay connected with a fast-changing world with m.voanews.com/English.
Hashtag VOA. It's a weekly show, Tuesdays at 1730 UTC, where we bring you the top topics of the week. But the show lives on social media every day with your daily video shorts, What's Trending Wednesday, and the Friday Fast Five. Subscribe to the show at YouTube. You can find us at hashtag VOA. You can reach me at Twitter, at Perry Cal, or talk to the show anytime. Please don't forget to like us on Facebook. We like to be liked. We love to be seen. And you can reach us anytime.
Two big pop stars are teaming up for a road trip to perform in front of their fans, but the tour came at the expense of another big performer. VOA Top 20 Countdown host Ray McDonald stops by our studio to explain what happened.
So kind of talk about Demi Lovato and her old pal Nick Jonas going out on tour together next year.
Two big stars hitting the road, and this is going to sure to please the fans.
Right. But there is an extra added element to this story, Jim, because this is a story of deception and betrayal. Earlier this month, Demi Lovato, the pop star, locked in Adam Lambert, fellow pop star, to open for her world tour next year. However, TMZ reports that Demi's manager, who also manages Nick Jonas, wanted her to replace Adam with Nick. Nick Jonas is hot. He's rising right now. He's had a few hits, but he doesn't have a tour. So Adam got dumped earlier in October. And unsurprisingly, he's not very happy about it. Angry words were exchanged between their two camps. But ultimately, things are going to turn out okay for Adam. On Monday, Demi and Nick sang together at a private concert in New York. These two have a history. Demi and the Jonas Brothers, Nick's old group, starred together in the Camp Rock movies for Disney. They've practically grown up together. In fact, this will be the sixth tour Demi and Nick Jonas have made together. In addition, Demi used to date Nick's brother, Joe Jonas. So he's practically family. So as you can understand, these two are very happy to be back on tour together. And both of them are riding very cresting careers right now. Mm-hmm. Demi's fifth album, Confident, just opened at number 2 on the Billboard 200 pop album chart. Nick's self-titled second solo album went top 10. He's spun off 2 big hit singles. And so they'll be hitting the road together beginning June 24th, 2016. In Sunrise, Florida. As for Adam Lambert,
He's going to be okay. He's doing a few radio station Christmas concerts here in the States. And in January, he'll tour Japan and Australia. And, of course, Adam Lambert is also the singer in Queen these days.
Mm,
so
right.
When Adam's not touring as a solo act, he's touring with Queen. So in the end, it's going to be okay for everybody.
Well, at least Adam Lambert has some working fans of his own to enjoy, and who knows? I mean, maybe he and Demi will get back together at some point.
You know, pop music makes strange bedfellows, in every sense of the term.
It does indeed, but we're certainly glad to have you with us each and every week. Ray McDonald, he's the host of the Top 20 Countdown. Be sure to catch him, and also on Twitter, Ray, it is...
Ray on the Hits.
Thanks so much for being here.
Thank you, Jim.
You've been listening to International Edition. Our website is voanews.com, and there you can not only find all the great news of the day and lots of other great feature stories, but our program is there, so stop on by when you have a chance. We're also on Twitter, our handle at @VOA_IE. We'd like to thank our director, Tracy Carter, and engineer, Aydin Utku, outstanding as always, and you for joining us. Come back again. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. We hope you have a great day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Once the fighting ends, peace treaties are signed and armies disbanded, too often the world assumes that life in former conflict areas will soon return to normal. But in many countries, landmines and unexploded munitions kill and maim their victims decades after the original conflict is little more than an ugly memory. Leftover landmines and unexploded munitions stand in the way of post-conflict stabilization and inhibit long-term development. They render thousands of acres of land unusable and destabilize communities. Clearly, people can only realize the benefits of a return to peace once these deadly hazards are removed. Since 1993, the United States has been part of a concentrated effort to clear and destroy poorly secured, unstable, or illegally traded conventional weapons of war. So far, we have invested $2.5 billion into this drive. In addition, every year the United States Department of State releases To Walk the Earth in Safety, a report which details the previous year's efforts to reduce the harmful effects of these remnants of war. This year's report notes that in 2014, four projects in particular stood out. First, we launched a five-year initiative to completely demine Vietnam's Quang Tri province and increased our funding for the clearance project tenfold. In the Middle East, we helped fund the Halo Trust's work in the West Bank, a first-of-its-kind effort to clear the mines there. In Tajikistan, we funded the first and only all-female demining team in Central Asia. And finally, we work to help destroy illicit and at-risk weapons and munitions stockpiles in Chad, Niger, and Bosnia and Herzegovina. To Walk the Earth in Safety not only provides detailed information of our programs in these countries, it makes clear the real differences these programs make in the lives of countless people, said Rose Guttermüller, Undersecretary of State for Arms Control and International Security. With the help of our NGO partners, we have turned one-time battlegrounds into land for vital infrastructure. We have cleared minefields so that farmers can get back to their fields and children can walk to school safely in Angola and other countries. These inspirational programs touch thousands of lives all over the world, from children in Sri Lanka who can now safely walk to school, to farmers in Vietnam who can now tend to their crops without fear.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.